Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Carl Rhodes.
Hey, I'm Christine Leo.
And I'm Natalie Trelaw.
And we'd like to welcome you all to another episode of Deterrence Down Under with the National Institute of Deterrence Studies. Just a reminder that the views of our hosts today are their own and don't represent any institution with which they may be affiliated or may have been previously affiliated with. Today we're going to talk about masks, and Natalie's going to set that up and introduce it in just a second, but just a few quick words first in terms of the deterrence news update here in Australia. I know that there was an election in the U.S. We're not going to talk about that because we could spend a whole episode just talking about potential implications of Trump. Maybe we'll do that later, but today's updates are focused on what's happening here in Australia. First of all, Japan is going to be sending across a rapid deployment brigade to train alongside U.S. and Australian forces in Darwin here in 2025. So there's a longstanding Marine Rotational Force Darwin that was started in 2011, and that has 2,000 U.S. personnel rotating through yearly during the April through October timeframe. That's the winter here where there's less rain up in Darwin. They tried to train during the summer. They would get rained out. In terms of other things, there's been a guided weapons and explosive ordnance plan released. And so that gets to, they're going to be buying Tomahawk SM2 3C block versions and SM6s. And there's also going to be a lot of manufacturing here. So the government here is building a new Australian weapons manufacturing complex, investing a total of $316 million into that complex. And it's going to be able to manufacture up to 4,000 of the GMLRS, the guided multiple launch rocket systems. That's a handful to say. It's going to be the first such facility built outside the United States. It's going to help supply weapons for all the forces. And also, there was an announcement that the government is partnering with Thales to produce 155 millimeter artillery shells at the Benalla munitions facility. It's going to be the first dedicated facility outside the United States to manufacture that round. And by 2028, they're going to be producing 15,000 rounds a year, and they're going to have the capacity to scale up to 100,000 rounds a year, which should support like 550 jobs. So that's a lot of mass, Natalie. Clearly a lot of interest in weapons. So I'll hand it over to you, Natalie, to introduce our topic today.
So... The recent strikes, so the strikes on October 16, the B-2 strikes against the five hardened underground facilities that the US conducted on Houthis weapons facilities, got us thinking about this concept of mass and asymmetry and range. So we thought we'd focus on the mass today, and both Clausewitz and Gemini considered mass to underpin the art of war. Clausewitz alluded to physical forces and material advantages, and he went on to describe it as relative superiority, that being the concentration of superior strength at the decisive point. Clausewitz deemed decisive point as a fundamental to the definition of mass, as the mere concentration of forces was not enough to achieve victory. Clausewitz focused on an enemy's center of gravity, while Gemini targeted an enemy's flanks and communications. Gemini also saw massed forces in relation to the enemy as well as across space and time. So, Carl and Christine, how do you see this concept of decisive superiority playing out in deterrence and response options? And do you think it's still a relevant concept?
Hey, Natalie, thanks. Yeah, I think the concept of mass is really interesting throughout military history. And I am certainly not an expert on military history per se, but, you know, I do kind of love reading this stuff. And I was reading a book I read a long time ago. Stephen Biddle wrote a great book about 20 years ago called Military Power, where he kind of unpacks the, How do you explain victory slash defeat in modern war? Modern war being sort of like late 1800s to the modern day. And he makes an interesting a few interesting arguments. And one of them is that it's not necessarily like we tend to think, and from different perspectives, sort of IR theory, strategic theory. We do tend to think of how we predict countries winning or losing in terms of who has superiority. And he's unpacked it using different case studies. And I think we see it today. Like, we thought Ukraine would be crushed within a matter of hours. I'm exaggerating a little bit here, obviously, but like in a matter of days or months. But like, the war has dragged on. And one of the arguments that Stephen Biddle makes is that it's not necessarily superiority per se, but the extent to which your forces can endure, in other words, force employment and or doctrine, as we can talk about it as well. And I think in terms of deterring war rather than waging war, I think there's, and I'm not sure where to go here, but like, I think there's something to unpack in terms of when we're talking about missiles, because missiles Some have called it the missile revolution. I was reading a great book yesterday by Donald McKenzie. This is like 30 years ago, called Inventing Accuracy, which is a fascinating history, like a social history of like the missile, as we've come to understand it, in terms of like the missile, in terms of military history, kind of contracts time and space. For humans, as we think about war and going to war and indeed avoiding war. But that being said, I'm not sure that conventional missiles in and of themselves are enough, and again, speaking to that broader concept of mass, are enough to deter war. I really think it is the nuclear warhead plus or times the missile, the concept of a missile, that really deters war. And this is kind of a shameless plug, but like a few years ago, as I was thinking about, you know, when nuclear disarmament was still kind of in vogue and Barack Obama was saying we would achieve nuclear disarmament within his generation, it got me to thinking, and it was a research project of mine. Okay, well, nuclear disarmament, all these strategic theories and concepts that we've come to develop throughout the Cold War because of missiles, times, nuclear warheads, how do we rethink those concepts in a world where we have missiles but we don't have nuclear warheads? Like, how do you unpack deterrence, extended deterrence, arms control, and so forth? How do you think about these concepts? And my professor, Robert Aisen, who's at the University of Wellington in New Zealand, we came to the conclusion that it really is nuclear warheads, times, long-range missiles that provide deterrence. And you can't really, like, even if you have mass conventional missiles, like, there's still, you take away that prospect of Armageddon, and so you remove the fear of going to war and therefore deterrence. But I know that Carl is much more technically savvy than me on, you know, inertial guidance, the gyroscope, etc. And he's currently working on a chapter for a book for NIDS on ICBM history. Carl, thoughts about accuracy and guidance and the role of that in modern warfare?
Yeah, exactly. I think there's, so look, I'm going to speak less from an ICBM point of view and more from an air power point of view. There is a big piece of air power and thinking about mass and accuracy that comes to play here with the advance of technology throughout history, going from World War II to kind of the Iraq War was the real revelation of precision air power. So World War II, you know, there's talk about mass and missiles and the Blitz against London. You know, there were large scale airstrikes on cities and things. And there was a belief, kind of at the time that, oh, this strategic bombing will cause the population to collapse and give up. And frankly, it had the opposite effect in London during the Blitz. It really brought the people together and solidified their resistance to Germany and their belief in the war. So yes, it caused a lot of damage, but it didn't necessarily break the will of the people like many people thought it would. And this is kind of a recurring theme. So, you look to the Schweinfurt mission where they were trying to bomb an important factory producing ball bearings, and they had to go in with hundreds of bombers, lost large numbers of bombers, and had almost zero effect on bombing the factory. So this idea of mass from the air did not have much success until we got to the ability to precisely place weapons where we need to place them, which also involves knowing where you need to place the weapons, that intelligence and surveillance and reconnaissance piece of it as well. So, you know, that's kind of the air power side. And if we move forward and think about, you know, modern air power history, we get to things like John Warden's theory of centers of gravity. And that gets to the Gulf War and, you know, thinking of the enemy as a system and where are we going to precisely put weapons to disrupt that system. And many argue that the, you know, the Gulf War was quite a success in terms of air power, but it wasn't the dominant factor. And, you know, there was great success and a lot of things done, but you needed the land forces to go in and finish off the job. So this is the whole question of thinking about accuracy and air power and mass. They all kind of come together. Like, just having mass isn't enough. You need accuracy and a knowledge of your enemy in order to where to put that mass as part of the total equation.
Carl, how do you see like the future of war as well? Like, when you're saying we need, you know, like, because having been around the army a lot, they still sort of believe that we need these boots on the ground. And I mean, you know, when they dropped the bomb on Japan, I mean, you couldn't really put people in there with boots on the ground and put up the white flag and go. And I mean, it wasn't about invasion either and taking over the country. It was about winning a war and those ends. So, I mean, and for Australia personally, I see us as we'd probably cop like punitive strikes, like stay out of the war, we'll nuke you. Stay out of the war, we'll bomb you. Or, you know, we're going to punish you anyway. And here's a strike. I can't see us having to mass land forces in Australia on some of these problems. But, and I think that comes back down to this, you know, when we're talking about sort of strategy, some of the way in which we talk about it in Australia as well, and is quite broad, and I still think it comes back down to what's the context and the scenarios that we're sort of looking at. Because when you look at, say, for example, the strikes on the Houthis weapons facilities, that's a specific scenario, and that response option, like we've, you know, it waited, I think it was like however many months, 12 months at least to come up with that. And there's already been a cost of, you know, the doubling of the freight costs, the fuel costs. And the same goes for like all of the costs in, you know, until they've made that decision to strike and take that out. And I, you know, do you think that drone on drone warfare is really the thing to be doing, or should we be, you know, taking out those weapons storage facilities from the get-go and going in hard and fast? Not being so afraid of escalation. And the same goes for sort of the, you know, like if we look at the cost in Ukraine war, some people said, you know, was deterrence successful? And it goes, well, was the US even trying to deter the war in Europe in the first place? And should it have potentially put that in its strategy? Because it's, you know, if we look at the cost of it, it's $152 billion direct cost of war damage in Ukraine. We're at its 1,000th day or beyond its 1,000th day. The cost to Russia has been $211 billion in February. Is some of the estimates, and the global aid as of February 2024 was $253 billion. So when we're looking at these costs later on, and some people, like you brought up the point of, you know, do you really need a B-2 to go in and bomb some things, or can you do it with cheaper things? Potentially, but when you look at those trade-off costs of the war and the outcomes and the days and the attrition of people, essentially, and where they live and weapons, are we thinking enough about those sorts of things too?
Yeah. So you just raised a ton of issues. There's a lot to unpack.
There's a lot going on in my head.
Yeah. So let's start with the Houthis and, you know, what's happened with those strikes. So you're talking about, you know, the B2 was called in to strike some deep underground storage. And the speculation was that they used one of these very large bunker busting bombs to take care of that. So, there's been a lot of disruption to shipping over time. And the United States has tried campaigns to take out the mobile shooters and the people doing the firing before this time. That's for sure. And didn't have much success. Like, this points to one of the limitations of air power and most any forces. Like, if the enemy is mobile and smart and, you know, uses deception and concealment and those things, it's hard to strike those targets in a timely fashion. And they're hard to take down, and it takes time. And the United States tried that approach, from what I have read, and wasn't very successful. I mean, there was a 2 or 3 day campaign run, I think it was in January or February, and the Department of Defense in the United States said, yeah, we ran this major campaign to try to take down the threat, and they're still probably 75% as effective as before we started with this. So that points to some limitations of air power. Now, going with the B-2s to use bunker busting, yes, I have no doubt it disrupted their operations for a period of time, but they are still firing, you know, these cruise missiles and things today against targets, and fired against some U.S. warships just recently. So does it affect them a great bit? Yes. Does it come at great cost to using an asset that is a valuable one? And, you know, the real value of it is in stealth and secrecy. And when you use it, you expose it. So there's a question there. And those penetrators are not cheap either. So there is a question of the cost versus the reward and the long-term benefit potentially of all these things. So, Christine, I'll throw it over to you for your thoughts on, you know, Natalie's list of topics that she raised for us.
Yes. It goes to those arguments made by Stephen Biddle that, like, it's not necessarily about mass per se, but, like, he does talk about dispersion of forces, protection of forces, because, like, again, one of his main arguments is that if, yes, you may have a super big military, but if you can't protect them for long enough or for however long enough, and they get decimated pretty quickly, well, you don't have much to work with. There's this great quote, and it's really great to get back into the theory a bit more. There's a great quote that's always stuck with me by Robert Art, and this is the generation of, you know, Robert Jarvis, John Mearsheimer, and so forth. He has this concept. It's called the gravitational use of force. And it's in a book called can't remember the exact title. But anyway, he says that force is never more operative than when it is known to exist but is not brandished. And I think that goes back to kind of, again, sorry, I'm, you know, I'm the nuclear girl. sort of as nuclear weapons, as having that unique gravitational use of force in deterring conflict, as in, like, yes, they exist, you don't have to threaten them per se for them to have a gravitational effect. That is, the enemy knows that you have these weapons. You don't need to brandish the sword. They're always operating in the background. And that's why a lot of US commanders have said throughout history, STRATCOM commanders, we use nuclear weapons every day. You can't really say that, or at least to the same extent, you can't really say that about conventional missiles, I don't think. But, you know, happy to debate.
As I say, I think that's exactly right, which is nuclear weapons are in a class in and of their own. They provide a destructive power that is just in a different class than anything you can produce conventionally, for the most part. So that gets to this question of, you know, nuclear weapons, and how do you think about the use of nuclear weapons and escalation, given that it's such a big step up from a conventional campaign. And I think that's where, look, Russia has used nuclear weapons to try to deter NATO and Western involvement in Ukraine. But they've pulled out the, you know, oh, we're going to use nuclear weapons or we're threatening nuclear weapons so many times. I think it's had less effect now. But to take that step up would be a major step. Let's hope it doesn't happen. But that's where I think there's a real challenge as to how do you think about escalation and where the step is. And in World War II, it was a case where only one nation had those weapons and didn't have to worry about another nation escalating back. But we no longer live in that world. Many players have nuclear weapons, and there's the chance of proliferation in the future.
Carl, you make a great point. And like it really is fascinating slash terrifying. You remember we had Peter Layton on a few months back, and I liked his terminology, this nuclear threat business. I think it's going to be really interesting going forward, because in terms of like countries or states that have used nuclear threats, I think just from memory slash impression, I think North Korea's been the most vocal on nuclear issues in recent history, and Pakistan and India to a lesser extent. But it is really interesting seeing rhetoric, the evolution of rhetoric around nuclear weapons, not just in Europe, but potentially going forward in the Asia Pacific, and you know what becomes normalized in terms of behavior and language, I think will be really interesting. And it also speaks to a question I think about warning time, and being prepared. It's such a rapidly evolving situation in terms of like, oh well, how do we interpret this? How do we interpret this? And Russia's saying this, and China's saying this. So, oh, how do we think about, you know, military preparedness in this brave new world? It's so interesting.
Yeah, you make a really great point there, Christine, about warning time, especially with the war in Ukraine at the moment and what we're seeing with China and Russia and their partnership with their relationships with North Korea and Iran as well going on. That warning time is definitely being cut down, right down.
Yeah, warning time is a big issue, and being ready and, you know, not having that time to build up, especially in modern warfare. If you're facing a well-equipped adversary that can bring a lot of mass to the fight and you don't have it yet, you will find yourself in a bad place, because warfare can progress much quicker than it could back in, you know, World War II times, in my opinion. The ability to reach out with long-range strikes, long-range missiles, long-range air power gives you the ability to touch an enemy further away with more mass than you could before.
And bringing that back to your earlier point, Carl, on Australia and its weapons-producing capability, how quickly do you think we're going to be able to ramp that up in time? And do you see a future of Australia supplying that to having an export market to Europe as well?
I think that's the goal, is to export these weapons, and you know, to Europe would be one place. The U.S. is another. So replacing some of those stockpiles that the U.S. has delivered in other places, I think. I mean, there's a lot of talk about we need to crawl, walk, run with regards to guided weapons. I think there's a lot of industry that is ready to roll. They need the contracts and the money. You give them the incentive to go, they can be moving much quicker than some of the government think they can move. This has always been the question.
I have to agree with you there. Being back in industry, I can see how quickly they can run. Providing you just hand them the cash and give them some high-level guidance, like, I need X thinking kind of whatever, and we'll go with it. And we'll get it done. Yeah, it's much quicker than sitting behind the desk with lots of paperwork and a lot of people not doing much. But
exactly. Yeah. And there's reticence of a lot of U.S. munitions manufacturers, those who manufacture the actual weapons and missiles. because these are the things that have typically been first on the cutting board when it comes to trimming the budget. So there's been promises of building weapons in the past and not delivered. So there's a reluctance on weapons manufacturers to build up large capabilities to ramp up quickly because the demand isn't there. So this is the other piece, is a consistent demand, and having that there to build up stockpiles will allow the industry to plan more long term. So that's another piece.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I've mentioned this before, but like Natalie and I were at the Stratcom Deterrence Symposium a few months ago, and we had the great privilege of having an industry panel, like specifically a panel for industry, and they were bringing these points up. And it's also a point that Frank Miller's brought up in the Peter Husey talks, you know, so much for consistency. And it's like, you know, supposedly we're living in the most dangerous era since pre-Second World War. What are we doing faffing about? Like, can we just, like... Can we just get on with it?
I think we've sort of the element of surprise has come in and taken us. I mean, yeah, I've seen it where we'd only have weapons enough to maybe conduct some exercises or with warning times of 10 years, but we haven't seen this where you may need immediate weapons availability. Yeah, and I mean, we're looking. We can. When I was at the Stratcom symposium, I had the privilege of chatting to a Swedish person, and he was saying, you know, we've given up our Patriots to Ukraine, and we thought we'd be able to just place an order and get them tomorrow, but they've got a 7-year wait for those things, and you know, they want weapons on their submarines as well, and because of the export restrictions from the US, they can't get them. So I think the US probably needs to look at that broader piece. The Europeans need to look at, you know, do we really want to be buying US weapons? Should we be making our own? And Australia should even be thinking about, you know, do we need to be doing this under US technologies, or can we ramp this up quickly with our own? I mean, we have smart people. They've all gone. A lot of them have had to go to the US because we just haven't had the industries here to retain them, and they've been able to go to the US. Whether that be anything from weapons manufacturing, pharmaceuticals, to all sorts of industries, they've had to leave the country to be able to do what they love.
And look, nations can do great things with the right incentives and the funding. So, I mean, let's look at the Ukraine. This is a nation, you know, that's fighting a war right now. They're building tens of thousands of unmanned systems to strike, you know, armored vehicles and things, because that's what they have to do. They can't buy the weapons from other places. And, you know, when we think about 10,000 of anything for a military purpose here in Australia, I mean, it's people start to kind of freak out. We could never do that. You know, we're a medium power. No, I think there are things that can be done. We have to think imaginatively, and we have to provide funding, and we have to provide, you know, the incentives to allow industry to move forward and people to be innovative.
Yeah, definitely. I think COVID was an example of how quickly the country can pull together as well, let alone, and the world as a whole too. So I'm pretty sure it can be done.
And it, you know, we had Hugh White on for our last episode, and I really liked some of the points he brought up about, you know, in the past we were able to do such things. So what's happened? You know, supposedly technology has evolved. Supposedly our systems are more efficient, or whatever. I'm not an industry expert at all, but like, why the inertia? Why the inertia? It's just baffling.
Maybe we should be unpacking the institutionalization of these things in future. Are we ever institutionalized, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great, great question for a future episode, is how can we create innovation and give, you know, the right incentives to what they call one of the fundamental inputs to capability, defense industry, right? So, I mean, it's hard to go to war if you don't have the right tools. And to get the right tools, you need to incentivize industry to produce them.
Yeah, and we'll wait to see how Elon Musk does that at the Department of, what is that, DOGE? DOGE?
Department of Government Efficiency, I believe.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing how that goes.
Get her down.
Okay. So today we examine mass, And mass, is it still a relevant principle of war? And how to think about applying mass and escalation and the relation between conventional and nuclear thresholds and thinking about deterrence and response options, all kinds of aspects of mass and, you know, how defense industry helps provide that. Thanks again for listening to Deterrence Down Under. Hope you enjoyed the show. We're hoping to do some more recordings of podcasts in the future. Get on your phone or whatever, however you listen to us, a little bit more often. And so we hope you enjoyed it. And just remember to always think deterrence. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.